All rise sign. That's a joke. Welcome to this, yes, Vice Chairward. January 21st, 2003, meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. We have a bit of an agenda to work through here today. And before I do, let me return to a subject that we discussed when we had our organizational meeting, which is in regards to an issue floating around the Capitol here in terms of swearing in and truthful testimony. On Thursday's meeting, there will be a sign-up sheet, as is normal, and that sign-up sheet will reference the two current ORSs, 171.764 and ORS 244.020. Which are the government standards and practices, definitions about conflict of interest and a whole host of things that we as elected and public officials are required to comply with. And also 171.764, which is in regards to false statement or misrepresentation by a lobbyist or public official and the defenses therein. Instead of going forward, as some committee chairs have, in terms of adopting rules that give the chair the option, which I still have, as I understand from legislative counsel, to require swearing in of certain individuals, we're not going to do that. We're simply going to have a sign-in sheet that says that if you sign in and you are a public official and you are a paid lobbyist, that you acknowledge that you understand both of these ORSs that apply to our testimony here today. And that is because our testimony oftentimes is used in the courts to determine legislative intent. And we want to make sure that legislative intent is based upon sound, accurate, and factual testimony by those of us who are involved in the process. This does not apply and will not apply to the average citizen who is not covered under the definition of the statute. Okay. It only applies to those of us who work in this building on a regular basis. And that, again, is clearly articulated in the statute. And having said that, we're going to move into our first issue, and we're going to open a work session on a legislative draft, LC 1388. Members, this is basically a very simple issue. None of them are simple, and this one certainly is not without controversy. It is the chair's desire that we would introduce this as a committee bill. To do that, we need a simple majority vote, up or down, on it. This basically repeals the statute prohibiting the use of bait to attract or take black bears or use of dogs to hunt or pursue black bears or cougars. There are multitudes of reasons why I have felt necessary to bring this issue forward at this time, and we're going to go in discussion on that. And just to let you know what the process is here, if we introduce this as a committee bill today, it goes to be printed, it will come back to this committee and be assigned, and we will enter in to them the full and normal methodology of debate in terms of public hearings and witnesses and so on and so forth. For the purposes of what we're doing here today, however, it's simply a matter of discussing this amongst ourselves and voting whether to introduce this as a committee bill or not. So therein lies the crux of the issue. Ray, anything to add before we get started in internal discussion?
No, Mr. Chair, from a procedural standpoint, exactly what the committee would be doing by sponsoring this measure would be giving an opportunity for debate in the legislative process.
Okay, very good. Members, the chair would entertain a motion.
Chair.
Mr. Vice Chair.
I move that we submit this as a committee bill.
Okay. It has been moved by Vice Chair Gilman that LC draft 1388 be submitted for drafting and printing as a committee bill. Discussion, members. Representative Nels.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It says repeals the statute prohibiting use of bait to attract or take black bears or use of dogs to hunt or pursue black bears or cougars. I don't think that's what we mean.
What do you think that we mean, Representative?
I think we mean the way it says repeals a statute prohibiting use of bait to attract, if you take out the or, it should say to attract, comma, pursue, or take black bears.
Okay. Ray, would you keep in mind that this is just a draft summary. Ray, would you go ahead and read us the ORS as it is so that we understand precisely as what it is that we're proposing to repeal?
Yes, Mr. Chair, and if I may refer the chair and members to the LC draft, there is a summary above the concept. And that's what was being referred to by the good representative. The submission of the LC draft itself, the relating to clause is relating to wildlife, and then it goes into the repeal of the statute. In the heading of the statute, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it states, taking black bear or cougar using dogs or bait prohibited, damage control and government management exceptions, hunting license suspension for violation. So what this is doing is repealing that statute which prohibits the use of dogs or any other type of bait for taking cougars and black bears, and along with it, it goes ahead and repeals the penalties for violation of that Oregon law.
Hey, Ray, what about the continuing portions of the statute as it's written in terms of damage control and government management exceptions? We would not be repealing that, correct?
That is incorrect, Mr. Chair.
We would be repealing
that. The LC draft, which is proposed for sponsorship, would repeal the entire statute 498-164. Okay. Therefore, that clause would also be repealed.
Okay. And also so then would be the license suspension for violation part of the statute also.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is correct. The license suspension for violation would not have an effect since there would be no violation.
That's correct. Okay, Representative Nelson, does that the summary sort of summarizes what we're trying to do? In essence, we're repealing that entire statute as it's currently written.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's what it should say because the whole purpose of the statute is not to make it illegal to take black bears and cougars.
Agree.
That's what we really mean.
Vice Chair Wirth and then Representative Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question I have then is currently we can't hunt privately. Private hunters cannot use bait or dogs to hunt black bears or cougars, nor can we manage them through the state in terms of damage control and everything. So now we are saying we may use dogs and bait to help manage these populations through the state, or any private hunter may also use dogs and or bait to hunt black bears and cougars.
No. Mm-mm, didn't say that.
You won't have your license suspended.
I think before we answer that, let's have Ray read through the statute to find that particular sub.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wirth, under sub 2 of 498-164, it states that employees or agents of a county are not prohibited. That's where the exception comes in terms of government damage control.
What about it?
Okay, so
I'm talking about individual.
Individuals under the current statute have the ability to obtain a license and hunt bear and cougar under any means except which is stated in here.
Right.
So by repealing that, then it's we will then allow that practice to occur once again as it did previously. And it also appears that the exceptions that were in the law currently for state agencies and I think what's it say again? Federal agencies.
Yes.
To manage those populations, that also that exception is also repealed at the same time.
Okay. So the in terms of an individual hunter, though, now they will not they will no longer face a license suspension if they indeed use bait and or dogs to hunt black bear.
Correct.
Okay.
That is correct. Representative Beyer.
Well, my question, and I don't know, but I was under the impression, and maybe by repealing this statute, this is what happens, that this would push it back under the jurisdiction of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Does that happen? You repeal this, or do you have to specifically say that they're going to be in charge of this?
Well, that's a very good question. It is my understanding that your assessment of that is correct, that there is already statute in place which allows ODF&W to manage populations. This changed that portion of that statute, as I understand it. Now, that is a question that we ought to flesh out as we work through the normal hearings process. Again, we're in work session right now. We're not going to be able to take public testimony on the introduction of the LC draft. That's a very good question. Ray, I would ask you to make note of that. I would ask that ODF&W make note of that so when the time comes, should it come, that we hear this bill in this committee, that we can answer that question because it is a very good question. Members, any additional thoughts? Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, just a question from a feeble freshman, just making sure I understand the process. The by passing this on, this doesn't give any seal of approval from the committee, and your intent is to hold hearings that would include an opportunity for proponents and any opponents to come and testify.
That is correct. If the committee chooses to vote this forward on a majority vote, it will be simply introduced as a committee bill. In reality, that's really not any different than whether I introduced it or one of you chose to introduce it also. You're certainly free to exercise your conscience on this matter, and the chair would appreciate if you give us the courtesy vote. If you choose not to, that's fine. I certainly can appreciate that and any sentiments that you may have in that regard. And, yes, we will go through the entire normal hearings process with this piece of legislation once it's printed and back to us in a bill form where we can discuss all these issues and have the various constituencies come here and tell us why they think it's a good idea and why it's a bad idea. Anyone else? Representative Nelson.
Mr. Chair, has there been an excess of black bears and cougars attacking individuals and livestock in the state since we last met?
Since we last met, are you referring?
2 years ago.
Are you referring to the 2001?
Yes, sir.
I would say yes. There has been. It has come to my attention that as late as last week, there was a cougar in Bend eating a deer in someone's backyard within the city limits. And those stories are increasing. We will have the opportunity to take testimony from the Department of Fish and Wildlife in regards to the numbers, what I understand are declining numbers of fawn and calf populations as a result of the overabundance of some of these animals. So,
and a follow-up.
And that's partly the reason for bringing this issue forward is, and let me make this statement now for the members of the committee and for the general public at large. As chair of this committee and as a representative, I am typically very nervous about bringing forth legislation that overturns the will of the people when they voted on it, irrespective of how I feel about it. And there isn't a whole lot of criteria that I have that makes an issue rise to the level where I would choose to do such a thing. Public safety is one of them. And when I perceive that people are in danger, irrespective of livestock issues, which are an issue to some people, it's an economic burden for those in the rural areas that depend on livestock and are being disadvantaged because of additional attacks. Irrespective of that, it's the life safety issue, and I am very concerned about that. We will see testimony on videotape of a mother asking us to repeal this because a cougar was trying to come through her back door window to get at her five-year-old son. And that rises to a very serious level, in my opinion. And that's why I've chosen to bring this issue in front of this committee to introduce it as a committee bill. And if in your infinite wisdom you choose not to do that, I understand I probably would then introduce it on my own, and it would probably be back here for our consideration anyway. That's not to say that we'll be able to pass it out of this committee, but I think it's a fair discussion for us to engage in. And that's what this process is all about, is debate. And that's why I would ask that we move this forward as a committee bill. And please, Representative.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair, and maybe to Ray. And does this ORS talk about the disposal of these animals?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, it does not speak directly to this specific ORS. It does not speak directly to the disposal of the animals. It cross-references ORS 498.012. ORS 498.012 refers to taking wildlife, damaging land, livestock, agriculture, or forest crops. And it's pretty specific. I have not researched or done specific research on that statute or, Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the question that you have posed, because what we're looking at from a procedural standpoint is this is not a bill. It will not be a bill until it is introduced by or sponsored by this committee or by an individual legislator and gets a bill number and comes back to the process for legislative debate and discussion. But as we currently look at it, it is not a bill. It's a concept, much like the 3,000 concepts that were drafted for the legislature. So I haven't gotten into the specific research yet.
And last follow-up, Mr. Chair, I would recommend that if we do agree to take this as a committee bill, that we include the disposal. I mean, why draft and then redraft and add an amendment? I mean, we know we've authorized the taking, but what we can do with them is something else. So I think we should include it.
Yeah, well, point well taken, Representative, and I do appreciate that. And I think that we'll have every opportunity and ought to have the opportunity to address that specific issue. And perhaps you may choose to do that by amendment once we get the bill in here and we start working the bill through the process. So thank you very much. Members, I'm going to take an informal poll at this point in time just to see, sort of gauge the consensus or just how the committee is feeling. Representative Smith, your thoughts? You want to introduce this as a committee bill and then work it through the process?
Yeah. We need to have the hearing.
I'd be happy to provide a courtesy vote, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Very supportive.
Okay.
No. Sorry, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
And Representative Platt.
I'd provide a courtesy vote.
Oh, okay. Great. Thank you.
Well, you know, we haven't voted yet, and you can certainly change your mind, Vice Chair.
I can go home tonight.
Okay, all right. and with that, the clerk would call the roll, please.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative
Hunt?
Aye.
Representative
Fire?
Here.
Aye.
Yeah, I can do it again.
Representative
Nelson? Aye. Representative Warren?
No.
Representative Gilman?
Yes.
Yes. LC 1388 is hereby adopted as a committee bill, and we'll come back to us at some point in time. We will close the work session on 1388 and open a informational meeting at this time. And by the way, members, thank you all very much for your graciousness. We're going to have, first off, we have three groups to testify today. The Oregon Department of Energy, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Division of State Lands. And we'll take them in that order, so if we could have the Oregon Department of Energy come forward, please. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
for the record.
Yes. Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Graney. I'm director of the Oregon Office of Energy. And I'd like to take about 10 minutes this afternoon to discuss, first, very briefly, what we do. Second, to discuss at more length the response to the energy crisis of 2 years ago with the help and support of important legislation that the legislature passed, we were able to implement and help the state respond to. Third, I wanted to talk briefly about biomass energy, I think a particular interest of this committee, and what's been done and what could be potential there. And finally, just a couple of thoughts about both the future and specifically issues that this legislature may face on energy. And I'd be happy to answer questions as I go along or afterwards. I have a couple of handouts I'll provide to the committee as well today as I go along. First, let me mention briefly what we do. The Office of Energy has a couple of missions. One is to work to assure a stable supply of energy. And we have a siting process that we provide technical staffing to the Energy Facility Siting Council that approves siting of large energy facilities, including power plants, transmission lines, and natural gas pipelines. That siting council is a citizen panel of independent citizens that we provide the staffing for. Second, we work with individuals, businesses, schools, local governments, and others to encourage the use of energy conservation and renewable resources. And the legislature has given us a number of tools to help these people through tax credits, low-interest loans, federal funds, in some cases other funds become available as well. All those efforts make our energy supply go further. It also helps Oregonians respond to and withstand price shocks when energy prices go up more effectively by being able to use less energy. And ultimately, we hope to transition to cleaner resources through the use of more renewable resources. Finally, our office is responsible for the safe shipment through Oregon of radioactive materials and the cleanup of radioactive waste in Oregon, including a number of sites that have we've cleaned up in the past. Lake County, for example, abandoned uranium mill tailings site. There's an abandoned uranium mines that were involved in the cleanup now. The decommissioning of the Trojan nuclear plant, where we're seeing that. We also represent the state on the effort to clean up the radioactive waste in the state of Washington at the Hanford site that has major potential impacts on Oregon. With that as an introduction, let me turn to what the legislature did last session to respond to the energy crisis. At that point, we were in a very serious supply situation and price situation for our electricity. And, in fact, people of both Oregon and Washington had been appealed to directly by Governor Kitzhoff and Governor Locke to take extraordinary measures to reduce their energy consumption in the fall of the year 2000 to avoid the kind of blackouts that California had experienced earlier that year. In the short term, those measures had significant impact. The people of both states in the short-term period through their own energy conservation efforts efforts to reduce consumption saved the equivalent of 800 megawatts of electricity, and that's the equivalent of a three natural gas power plants these days or about two of the large dams on the Columbia River. So it was a significant energy savings. But that was short term. And the legislature passed four key bills last session that had a substantial impact on our situation. Two of those dealt with the energy siting process for siting large energy facilities, Senate Bill 843 and House Bill 3788. They simplified the process, expedited the review, and in some cases eliminated the need for a contested case hearing if a facility was located at a site that was, for example, the site of an existing industrial or energy facility and met certain other conditions that would limit the environmental impact of that facility. The legislature also passed two important bills, Senate Bill 520 and 521, dealing with our energy conservation programs to make our tax credits for individuals and businesses more effective and to continue the residential tax credit program. And this, in these cases, I know sometimes it's not clear when a bill has an impact and what the long-range impact is, but these are situations where we saw some immediate changes and some very positive results. For example, since the passage of those bills, our siting council approved 2,000 megawatts of new energy facilities. That's the equivalent of six or seven of these new power plants. And 225 megawatts of that has already come online. Now, that coupled with another 2,000 megawatts of power that had been under construction prior to last session has all come online and is operational in Oregon. And those power plants, coupled with power plants being built in other states in the region that have made similar efforts, has greatly stabilized our power supply situation. In addition, we saw major investments in energy conservation and renewable resources. On the residential side, we had 20,000 individuals each of the last 2 years invest $12 million in energy savings equipment that's eligible for our tax credit. We also had over 1,000 businesses invest $100 million in energy savings measures each of the last 2 years. And that's been a volume of effort that's more than double what businesses had invested under that tax credit program previously. Our low interest loan program provided $16 million in new energy loans this last year, and we have another $50 million in applications pending. So it's had a substantial impact. The current wisdom of the regional energy planners, which is always the only thing you can say about energy forecasts, is they're always wrong. But the current thinking is that the energy supply situation should be stable for the next 4 or 5 years, that we're in pretty good shape throughout the region, both in supply and, at least in the short term, in terms of price, that the wholesale market has come back down to normal. Our retail rates are not dropping. I'm afraid they probably never will, or at least not in the foreseeable future, but at least we're avoiding the situation where we had these enormous and catastrophic price hikes on the wholesale market 2 years ago with the supply shortage that we had. Another thing that we have done is we've worked closely with an investigation the Attorney General's office has undertaken. We and the PUC staff provided technical and investigative support for work that they have done on the overcharges that occurred in the wholesale market, resulting in a settlement with one supplier, the Williams Company, that's going to provide $15 million to Oregon that as part of that settlement that will be used for general restitutionary purposes as determined by the Attorney General. We also hope that other settlements will occur, and there's also the possibility of litigation against other companies if those settlements don't occur. So there may be some further benefits there. Let me turn briefly to biomass energy. And actually, before I do, John, if you could pass this out. Here's provided for the committee a summary of the legislation that was passed last session, and on the back side of that page is a listing of the large energy facilities that have both come online and that are under review and that have been approved and that are under construction now as a result of the legislation that this legislature passed last session. Biomass energy, and we use that term to cover energy that's fueled with wood waste, farm waste, forest, agricultural, any kind of biodegradable materials that can be used for energy. And biomass energy has played a significant role in Oregon in the past. In fact, it does right now. It's used in a variety of ways, like natural gas is, so that we have industrial use for direct heat. We have heat processing. We have in some cases hot water heating. We have in some cases electricity production through biomass energy. Most of that has been from call the forest waste side of it, but not all. Some is from agricultural waste as well. And in fact, about 10% of Oregon's energy consumption is from biomass energy. That's about half of what natural gas is used in the state. So it plays a significant role. And biomass energy is a renewable resource under Oregon law. It's eligible for our incentive programs. It's a type of resource we like to see used because of the environmental benefits of burning and using cleaner fuels that are biodegradable. For example, our business tax credit, we've had over 200 projects totaling over $45 million under the life of the program using biomass energy. And we've provided another $50 million in loans through our low-interest loan program for biomass projects. So we'd like to see more of them. One of the things we've not seen much of is the use of biomass for fuel, for automobile fuel. And one of the things the chairman of this committee did during the interim was convene a task force to focus specifically on the greater use of biofuels, such as ethanol and biodiesel from farm waste and forest waste. And there are, I think, a lot of promising things came out of that committee, which I'm sure we'll be visiting at some point. There were a number of good ideas there that I think has a lot of potential and would certainly be a benefit to the state if we were able to make those work. And I have for the committee a handout that's a directory of the biomass energy facilities that are in existence in Oregon right now. There are a substantial number, but you will see they deal with a number of them are combustion facilities, some cogeneration from lumber mills. There's also wastewater treatment facilities that are using methane recovery and other methods to take advantage of the energy implications of and the energy advantages of biomass energy. So it's used widely. We'd like to see more of it used in a positive way that would have, we think, both energy benefits and environmental benefits and economic benefits as well.
Indeed.
Yes, Mr.
Question
Chair.
For you in regards to, and I'm looking back on my notes and your testimony, the issues of the tax credits, mm-hmm. your business energy tax credit, so forth. Mm-hmm. In your opinion, have you seen since those have been in place, and we've expanded them over mm-hmm. time? Have you seen an increase in, I mean, you mentioned some statistics about, I think about 20,000 individuals invested $12 million, and I'm assuming that's residential, and 1,000
yes.
businesses, $100 million.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Do you really believe that that's as a result of having some of these incentives in place as a carrot? Mm-hmm. for these people to make those investments for energy efficiency?
I do, Mr. Chairman. And the reason I do is because the statutes have changed over time as to what's eligible and what's not. And when we've seen changes, we've been able to see the market shift. For example, when energy-efficient appliances were made eligible in the residential tax credit a few years ago, dealers told us that they saw a shift by purchasers to much more energy efficient but much more expensive appliances. They cost more up front, but the tax credit really made a difference on moving people to that kind of investment. Another area we saw was on the business tax credit where and I think it was a combination of two things where the size of the eligible project that could qualify for the tax credit was increased, and that was actually done 4 years ago where previously, projects were limited to $2 million in size, and they were increased up to $10 million. And combining that with the energy situation we had 2 years ago, we saw a number of cogeneration facilities come in, multi-million-dollar, $5, $10 million projects that we had not seen for quite a few years. And we also saw the volume of business investment had been in the $40 to $50 million range through the year 2000, and then it was nearly $100 million each of the last 2 years. And I think that was driven by the need to cope with energy prices. I mean, we had many companies had to lay off thousands of workers because they couldn't afford the energy costs. And you know, one of the things that we think our tax credit program really helps businesses stay in business and cope with these crises.
Very good. Please continue.
Looking ahead, we don't have any legislation that we're introducing or asked to be pre-session filed. We think the bills that were passed last session, there were major changes and are important and are working well. But there are some issues that I think are facing both the state and the region. And one of the things we've done, provided today, and we have copies, John, if you could pass those out, of our energy plan. We issue this energy plan every 2 years. And this kind of lays out some of those issues. The plan also includes a sort of a primer of our energy supply situation today, how much energy is used by different categories that we hope you'll find useful. But a couple of key issues that I think we have. One is there's a serious concern about the capacity for transmission lines, transmission line access. And it's a regional issue. It's not just a state issue, obviously. But there is a limit to how much infrastructure we have, both transmission line and I think to a lesser extent, natural gas pipeline capacity, if we continue to see an increase in the number of natural gas facilities that are planned to be built. Our infrastructure has been neglected, and it's a difficult issue because no single company or no single entity owns the infrastructure. And electrical transmission lines, Bonneville Power Administration owns a substantial portion. They are trying to get financing to expand their transmission lines. That requires congressional approval. And while it's self-financed through rates, it still shows up on the federal budget as an expenditure, and there are federal budget issues there. The other transmission lines are privately built and have been owned by a combination of different utilities in the past, but those lines need to be expanded, particularly for sites such as wind that is resource specific, wind and geothermal. You can't build where you want to, you have to build where the resource is. Our transmission system wasn't built to take those into account, and we need to look at that. It's the same with natural gas pipelines. As the region has continued to move to natural gas away from resources like coal and nuclear power, our natural gas infrastructure has not kept pace, and I think that needs to be addressed as well. Finally, I think we're not out of the woods on pricing, price issues. I think for the next few years, and by that I mean 2 or 3 years, I think the wholesale market will be pretty stable. I am concerned that we are seeing, for a number of reasons, including financing problems, the economy generally, that power producers who have applied for power permits are not going forward with construction. We haven't seen much of that in Oregon in the past. We've seen more of it in other states, but we are beginning to see that in Oregon now. And you know, a site certificate from a state doesn't guarantee power supply. The whole system has to work. I mean, that site certificate is one part of it. It's an important part of it to make sure the plant is sited in a way that meets state standards. But there are many other pieces, including adequate transmission capability and access, adequate financing, that all really came into play and came crashing down in the aftermath of the California deregulation and the impacts it had on throughout the West 2 years ago. So those are issues that I am concerned about and I hope we can avoid, and our plan gives some suggestions on ways to do that. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions or provide more information.
Michael, we have an ethanol plant that is scheduled to be built in Oregon. My understanding should be operating by the end of 2004. That's the first time we've been able to achieve that, haven't we?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that would be correct. Is that the one up at Clatskanie? Yeah. And that would be a very large one. That would be, was it 100 million gallons? 100 million gallons annual production. And that would, I think, be a great boost for the region. Much of their product would be shipped from the Midwest, unfortunately, at least initially, but the developers have committed to working with the local agricultural community so that they could use Oregon product as well. And there's interest in one or perhaps two other facilities that would be smaller in eastern Oregon, with Boardman and perhaps LeGrand, and those would be primarily using Oregon agricultural products and agricultural waste. So I think there's some encouraging signs there.
Very good.
Mr. Nelson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it Dr. Graney?
No, okay. It's Mike.
Director Graney. First of all, I just want to tell you that in our last Ag Committee, we had one of only three economic development projects identified in the last session, and it was the use of straw for cogeneration.
Great.
Do you know the success of that program?
Do you, John? Let me, I've got my biomass expert here, John White. Let me ask John.
For the record, Adam, my name's John White. I'm not familiar. Can you give me a little more information about what project that was?
Well, it was an economic development program. Came out of our Ag Committee and just authorized the use of straw, you know, in the production of energy and cogeneration. I'm just wondering if it went anywhere. If not, we need to put it in Representative Smith's committee and go back and, you know, put another plug in for it.
I'm not aware of any project operating that's using straw. Straw is eligible for our incentives as well, and we would like to see it happen, and we would certainly support those efforts and everything we can to support it.
Thank you, Paul.
Sure.
Absolutely. I was proud of that because there were so few, you know, suggestions that came from government on economic development, which we needed so desperately last time. I'm really, I'm trying to be really nice about this tax issue, but, you know, shouldn't there have been, I mean, on this deceptive pricing by the utility companies, what could we have done to prevent that? I think that is that we had a responsibility to the citizens.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, first, it's very complicated, and the problems were occurring on the wholesale level, where our utilities have to buy power when they don't have, you know, sufficient power themselves, and the wholesale market is generally unregulated. FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, does have authority to set price caps, and eventually. And we asked, and Governor Kitzhaber asked and pushed early on in the energy crisis, as well as did the other governors of the western states, for price caps from FERC. And FERC was very, very slow to respond. They finally put in a too little, too late, half-hearted price cap that, after the damage was done and after new supplies started to come in that by themselves started bringing the pressure of the pricing down. The investigations that the states are undertaking is an attempt to try to get some recoupment of those overcharges. And this Williams settlement is the first of what I hope will be a series. And it's only a settlement, and it was a settlement in part because, and they don't admit liability, they don't admit wrongdoing under the settlement, but they do agree to snitch on everybody else as part of the terms of the settlement. But it's terribly complicated to prove guilt. And so under the settlement, they agreed to pay Oregon $15 million, pay Washington $15 million, and pay California additional sums based on their amount of power consumption. The Attorney General is continuing to look and investigate the other cases, as are the other western states, the other major suppliers, and we're involved in that and assisting them with the PUC. And, you know, we'll continue to do what we can to try to, get to the bottom of this. The federal government is now investigating as well. FERC has shown some more enthusiasm for investigating after the fact, I think in response to a lot of congressional criticism as well from the western states, from the members whose, you know, citizens suffered these huge price increases.
Well, follow up, Mr.
Yes.
Chair. You know, based on the concept that we public servants have to inspect what we expect, could you help us draft some kind of a bill that would either bring about greater penalties for these jerks or, you know, be a protective vessel for the citizens? Could you?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we'd be happy to work with you on that.
Thank you. And just a couple more questions. That makes me very happy, and thank you. And I feel good to go home and talk to all those poor senior citizens that, you know, it took their last $7 to pay their utility bill. I'm so furious about it. Since Oregon's the seventh largest importer of garbage, and the state of Washington is the 12th largest exporter of garbage, and we're receiving 5.5 million tires from the state of Washington every year, being put into our good soil to become a rubberized pasture. And we also accept another 3 million tires from Idaho, as well as the 3.5 million we generate. Why can't we use that in some form of energy generation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, the garbage we can, and there's a small garbage burner in Brooks, just north of Salem here. It's about 15 megawatts. Probably the biggest single thing that's been driving not using it more is the economics. It's a lot cheaper to landfill it, unfortunately. And I think to some extent that's true of tires as well. We really haven't seen, and there's been a lot of examination of using tires for energy, but I don't know of any, it's not in our region, I don't know, are there any elsewhere, John, are you aware of any?
We've heard of the technology to convert tires into power, but it's kind of messy, frankly. It would be a combustion process, and there are air emissions issues, and again, I think it is an economic barrier to using them in that way.
Well, a follow-up, if I could, Mr. Chair. Well, I would certainly appreciate then, if you're not going to burn them, to direct them to RB Rubber in McMinnville so they don't have to import another $5 million from Canada, because these are going into our ground instead of into usable asphalt or fuel or any other good product, and we'll take them all. And last, do you have some economic development programs that are ready, and what did they say last session on the burner? You know, not ones that'll take, you know, 10 years, but ones that we can put people to work this year that we can help you get going and get some of this $436 million from Department of Economic Development being used for something that brings jobs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we do work with Department of Economic Development. Our programs are focused on energy, but they help keep the businesses that are working able to stay in business in terms of dealing with their energy costs through our and through their investments using our programs in energy technologies and energy savings measures. And we've offered those to businesses that are either considering expanding in Oregon or relocating to Oregon, so that the design of their buildings, the design of their manufacturing facilities, would be more energy efficient. And in some cases, and one recently, it was a major factor in a lumber company expanding one of its existing facilities here. But we do try to do use these programs in a way that helps economic development.
And last,
make it quick. We're going to move
where
on.
Where would we get the other $50 million to help these people that won't need these low energy loans? You said there's another. You have $50 million. $50 million of loans pending.
Right.
That tells me a lot of people need help.
But Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, those are loans that I expect will be approved. We have an approval process, and we have financing through our loan program. It's financed with general obligation bonds. So in that case, we have the financing, yes.
Okay, just quick, we've got to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, can you tell me how much the public purpose fee from Senate Bill 1149 has accumulated to date?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Worth, I believe for the for 2002 it was about $50 million. It will be higher in 2003 and in years thereafter because that law was delayed until March of 2002. And that most of that money is being administered through a nonprofit organization overseen by the Public Utility Commission.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair, I'd like to call Department of Fish and Wildlife to come forward, if you would, please. Welcome, Captain Ball. Captain slash Director Ball, my apologies.
That's fine.
I knew you as Captain Ball before you became Director. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Hopefully I can get through this today with my sinuses.
Director, state your name, sir.
My name is Lindsey Ball. I'm the Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. We were asked today to come forward and give you an overview of the department's legislative concepts and some of the issues facing the agency this legislative session. To kind of bring focus to the department with respect to statutory authority, you'll find the statutes that give the agency purpose and responsibility and authority from Chapter 496 through Chapter 513 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. It is our charge to prevent serious depletion of indigenous species and to provide optimum recreational aesthetic benefits for present and future generations of the state. The largest issue we have, I think, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this session, of course, is, as with any agency, is the budget. And we've identified that it's incumbent upon the agency to request a fee increase this legislative session to ensure current service levels. No enhancement to any agency program or anything, but just simply to maintain what we have today. Earlier in the year, we held 9 town hall meetings. I'm somewhat of a fan of town hall meetings. I like to get out and talk to the public and find out what they think about the agency and its programs and what it's important to be funded and what's not. We had over 1,000 people attend those town hall meetings. That's a bit of a hallmark for this agency. We haven't had that kind of turnout for some time. I was pretty excited about it, and I thought we got some pretty good feedback. There were 4 things I want to bring to your attention that were consistent at each one of those meetings. When we put up a list of cuts in order to balance our budget for 0305, we either cut services or We added revenue to licenses and tags to balance the agency's budget for the current service level. But the one thing that people told us they did not want to see cut from the agency's budget was they didn't want to see Fish and Wildlife Enforcement officers, field staff, biologists of ODFW cut. Now, depending upon where you were, one of those two issues would come up first. Just depends on who happened to call you would call on, but that was the first one that came up. They don't want to lose their local people. They then advised us that they did not want to see hatcheries cut in the state of Oregon. And then the fourth thing that was consistent throughout the state of Oregon, they did not want to see assistance programs to landowners diminished. Sportsmen, I think this is quite a tribute to the hunters and anglers of this state. They saw the value of private lands with respect to their recreation, and where they can help out with some assistance programs to private landowners, they want to continue that. House Bill 2260, which is our fee bill, would raise a total of $2.3 million in the 0305 biennium, and that would maintain current service levels for this agency. To kind of give you an idea, a thumbnail sketch of what the increases are engaged with, we did form a close-knit what we call a close-knit group called the External Budget Advisory Committee. Close-knit is used loosely, but there are 25 people on that committee that advise us on what a fee structure should look like. They all agreed that across the board for licenses and tags, you should look at about a $5 increase. For some of the specialty tags, such as antelope, bighorn sheep, mountain goat, you should charge another $10. And then the other advice that we received from the public was you should take the same percentage increase on tag and license increase and apply that to non-residents. In other words, if it was a 25% increase for a resident hunter, it should be a 25% increase for a non-resident hunter. And that's how that budget was, that's how the fee proposal was brought forward. The next on our list, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, is House Bill 2258, which repeals the sunset on hunting license fee surcharges that creates the Access and Habitat Board program in the Department of Fish and Wildlife. That is a $2 surcharge on each hunting license, and that money goes to provide access to private lands. Oftentimes, lands are leased. Sometimes a landowner only wishes that there be an enforcement officer present on the leased property to ensure that there's no vandalism or trespass issues. But that opens up, during the 99-2001 biennium, opened up 3,756,667 acres of private land to the public. That's a fair piece of ground that people are allowed to access as a result of that program. Another example of how that program has worked this last year, I think everyone's very familiar with the 2002 fire season. We in the Department of Fish and Wildlife, through the Access and Habitat Board, they authorized the expenditure of $132,446 to seed 7,829 acres of private land that was burned by wildfire this last summer. We worked cooperatively with several agencies and institutes to come up with an appropriate seeding program, and we allowed the landowners to pick the appropriate seed for the habitat in the area that their land existed in.
Lindsay, just
sir.
A quick note. It seems to me that I testified in front of a hearing asking if we could reinstitute a policy of using Oregon grass seeds for me being a grass seed farmer. I actually had a constituent who was a friend and a grass seed farmer to ask me to show up at that meeting and ask that question. And since then, I understand that your advisory committee had made a decision to utilize, in some cases, or at least allow Oregon grown grass seeds to be utilized in that capacity for habitat restoration, soil erosion issues after a fire. When you get a moment, would you ask one of your people to report to me if we were successful in that, in terms of using any of those grass seeds for that purpose?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, I can certainly do that. Many of the grass seeds raised in Oregon were on our list of choices for the landowner. Now, we couldn't dictate to them that they buy from a particular company, but oftentimes, Oregon residents buy Oregon, but we can sure let you know what those lands were seeded with. I think we have that on record.
Very, very good. Well, I'm going to appreciate that. And previously, we had been they just weren't using the.
Right.
There was a native grass concern. I think there was probably a greater concern on the part of the federal government as opposed more to your department, but. I do appreciate the fact that your advisory committee was willing to look at making that change, and I'd just like to see if we were successful.
I'll have Ron Anglin from our Wildlife Division make sure that you're advised on the specifics of those projects.
That'd be great. Thank you, Captain Moore. Please continue.
House Bill 2259 extends a similar surcharge on angling licenses to the Fish Restoration and Enhancement Program. That program is utilized to provide maintenance on hatcheries, purchase of things like a fish liberation truck, equipment in the hatchery environment. We also, on the enhancement side, that's on the restoration side of that program. On the enhancement side, we look at things like angler access, simply renting or leasing a boat ramp from a private landowner so anglers can launch their drift boats in certain places is a real plus for the angling community. We also use it to install new hatchery technology and equipment, conducting aquatic inventories, monitoring, and research. Those $2 generate $3.2 million per biennium. And that money is in the previous months during the 2001-3 biennium, there's been $818,000 spent on hatchery propagation activities, $150,000 on restoration, monitoring efforts, $72,000 for fish passage. This is an example of some places where that money's been spent.
Lindsay, another question for you, just briefly. I'm assuming this is one of those dedicated funds that we had some problems with in the prior administration at ODF&W in terms of the usage of that fund. Is that correct?
Chair Krupp, members of the committee, that's exactly right.
And since your administration has come along and the legislature has paid a little more attention to this, you know, it looks like these funds have been utilized more for the purposes of which they're collected. How much money got left in there right now?
I can't give you an exact tabulation, Chair Krupp, of where the money is, exact amounts today. I can, by contacting Pam Ryan, she'd bring you the active file. But I can tell you that by the end of this June 30th of this year, this department will have paid back all those dedicated and obligated accounts, and that's a total of $6.5 million that we started in the hole when we started this biennium. Those accounts now are a running account. You can walk down any day of the week and pull that file out. And you can see exactly what's in those accounts. Before, they were not. They were pooled in one big lump sum. No one knew for sure what money they had. But a couple things that have helped us with that. One, the staff in the department didn't want to ever see that happen again. Secondly, we meet on a monthly basis with both the Budget and Management of Department Administrative Services and our legislative fiscal analyst as well. Show them the books, and on a quarterly basis, we submit a report to the emergency board so that people knew exactly where we were with our money and our accounting. And we've got that refined today. As I said, you can walk in any time, pull that out. We can show you just exactly where that money is.
Captain Ball, I have to compliment you and your agency under your leadership and the team you've put together. You've done a great job at working yourself out of this hole. And I'm glad that we were, the legislature's wisdom was to allow you that opportunity. And you've done a good job. I'm real proud of you.
Well, Mr. Chair, it was a partnership from the word go. We had a few rocky days to get started the last session, but once we did, I think everyone recognized that we needed to get together and find a solution. And we're going to deliver.
You are, and I am expecting that you will have laid the groundwork for a solid financial foundation of this agency, which it hasn't experienced for a very long time. And I'm very, very pleased with that. Please continue.
And also, Chair, I might add, with the governor's balanced budget that's before legislature, I feel very comfortable with this agency being able to provide the services that the public expects from it. I think we're all right.
Very good. Nice to hear that, by the way.
Legislative concept 635/5 deals with the placement of explosives. And this is somewhat of a house cleaning bill. Placement of explosives and harmful substances in water. That's really handled by the Department of Environmental Quality. This statute was put in place prior to DEQ coming about. We don't do this work anymore. We just simply want to get it off the books and clean up the statute and put the appropriate authority where it resides in the Department of Environmental Quality.
And Lindsay, did you talk about House Bill 2209? Hunting of game animals and birds from aircraft.
Just a moment. Mr. Chair, thank you. I skipped over that.
Yep.
I went from R&E right to the other LC. House Bill 2209. Last year, we discovered with a tuberculosis outbreak over in Central Oregon at a surrogate ranch facility, we were making plans that if that disease had escaped the impoundment and gotten into the wild, of harvesting some game animals, deer and elk in that area, as well as other small animals with the use of an aircraft to try to either contain it or sample. We discovered that our laws do not allow us to do that. Now, if that disease had actually escaped the Cervid Ranch impoundment, which there was a strong potential of that taking place as a result of how the diseased animals handled, that disease would have gotten into the livestock industry, and we would have lost TB-free status in the state of Oregon, and that would have been a real adverse impact to the industry. We're asking that the legislature to give us the authority under these circumstances to use aircraft to not only sample, but do some research on animals that may be carrying disease. I think it's, and it also could, under some cases, enter into a public health issue as well. It's a tool that I think we need, and I think the people of Oregon need.
Very good.
Thanks for calling my attention to coming back to that, sir. A couple other issues just for everyone to ponder on a little bit. The Oregon Salmon Hatchery Research Center is a concept that we've been reviewing and shaping for our mothballed hatchery at Fall Creek down on the Alsea River. Not to bring up and open up old wounds, but that was the location of the famous or infamous fish clubbing incident. I've got... The department's got the property, it's got the water rights, it's got the facility, it's got the buildings. What we don't have is, in the state, like other states, is a research center to do research work on fish. Washington has it, Idaho has it, British Columbia has it, California has one. What we're proposing is to site a facility at Fall Creek that will allow us to do fish research. And we don't want to do research that's duplicative. So we've been working the last few months with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to determine all the research that's being done on fish throughout the region and coordinate our research efforts so that we can do what's going to be best for Oregon. And if someone's doing the same research someplace else, we'll just borrow from them when they're done with it. It comes with a high price tag. We estimate that that'll cost about $7 million. Now, there is $1.8 million sitting in a separate account in the Department of Fish and Wildlife that was paid to the department by the Portland General Electric for loss of fish at their Sullivan Power Generating Plant at Willamette Falls. That was an agreement that was reached with PGE in 1971 and had not been looked at until about a year and a half ago. Both PGE and the department felt it was necessary to clean that up. We agreed finally on a loss of fish and value associated with it to be $1.8 million. That's sitting in a separate account in ODFW, similar to the dedicated and obligated accounts, Mr. Chair. The money has not been touched, and typically mitigation for fish that are lost in a system, that money will generally go back into the system, but we, in the agreement with PGE, we agreed that that money could be spent in the agency with legislative oversight. And so we brought it right back into this legislative body for oversight on that expenditure. So that's the agreement we have. Now we are looking for some other funds along the way, but that is something that we are working on. I think It's important for the state of Oregon to regain its status as a leader in fish aquaculture that we once had back in the 60s and 70s. As I told someone the other day, and you'll probably hear me coin this phrase, research provides us knowledge, and knowledge provides us perfection in our management programs. Just like agriculture or timber industries or anything else that we do, field of medicine or anything, and we've got to make the investment. It's a partnership with Oregon State as the concept rolls out. And the other good part about that is we can get those students involved in that research work, and they'll come out of there with the best and brightest and latest information, and I can hire them and put them to work in our aquaculture facilities. So I think it's a win-win all the way around if we play it right.
Sounds very good, members. I have to tell you that I think this is one of the greatest concepts ODF&W has come to the forefront with, because what they're talking about doing is not only this be a research facility for just research, but they're also talking about modifying the old hatchery to make a research hatchery facility that mimics nature, which I think is an excellent concept. Because it may revolutionize how we view hatcheries throughout America, and clearly in North America. It's a great idea, and this is a great candidate in terms of a facility for that. And I really hope at some point in time we come up with the dollars to do this, because it's got real potential.
Well, I think we're going to continue to work on it, Mr. Chair, and see what we can do with it.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Mr. Chair, can I ask you, how does that differ from a conservation hatchery, or is that what we're talking about?
Well, a conservation hatchery that we've been working on as well still mass produces fish. I'm talking about thousands of fish. What we want to do at a research facility, and I'll just throw this out just as an example of research. We in the wild, a male and female fish select the partner that they're going to spawn with. In the hatchery environment, we don't allow that to happen. We take one fish and we grab another fish. Sometimes we take five and six females and fertilize them with one male. But what we have found, and it's true in many animal species throughout the world, the male and female, there's characteristics about one another that they identify with that they key on their offspring being more apt to survive. Now, simple things like that are some things that we need to ask a question of. And I've used this as an example several times, and this goes back 30 years ago, and the practice hasn't really changed that much. But I was at Big Creek Hatchery down the lower Columbia River, and that day happened to be when they were taking eggs at the Big Creek Hatchery, and they started pushing some of the fish up towards one end of the egg-taking station, and they'd already spawned six females. And they're going to get a male. And the fish turned as they crowded him up towards the one end of the tank. And the fish turned and bit the boot on one of the hatchery tacks. And he said, "Hey, you bit my boot." Well, that became the fish that was the best fish to spawn with those other fish. Now, gung-ho, love it all, but guess what? It may not, in nature, it may not be the best way to do business. And I
thank God we don't hate that way in human beings in America. Or black widow spiders, for that matter.
But what little studies have been done on selection of male female partners in fish aquaculture, it's been quite revealing. And many times. Hatchery fish are ignored by wild fish, and I think there's some things that we can do in our hatchery environment that can change that. We certainly need to start doing the research to determine it. So hatcheries are not going to go away. We're going to have hatcheries. For heaven's sakes, let's make the best of our hatcheries.
Absolutely. Yep. Lindsay, I'm going to ask you to wrap this up in the next 5 minutes.
Okay.
So we can hold our questions. Perhaps we need to keep moving here to get done today.
And I'll certainly come to anyone's offices to visit with anyone, too, later on. Wolves are going to disperse from Idaho into Oregon. We've gone around the state, held 15 town hall meetings. As I mentioned earlier, I like town hall meetings to get input from the public. More than 2,000 people have came to those meetings to talk about their concerns with the wolf coming to Oregon. It hasn't been here for about 70 years in any numbers. And a wolf is an animal that we're not that familiar with as far as a society in Oregon. The wolf eats meat. And that causes a real concern for our agriculture industry. It causes a real concern for hunting groups throughout Oregon because they're going to eat deer and elk as well. And then on the other side, we have advocacy groups, interest groups, who feel that Oregon should have wolves returned to its ecosystem for the balance of nature that it started out with before the advancement of European man. We don't have a bill or anything, but I'm sure there's going to be some bills floating around legislature that we're going to have to deal with. Lastly, Mr. Chair, I did include on the last page a summary of the amount of money that hunters, anglers, and wildlife viewers spend in the state of Oregon during the year 2001. This comes from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service survey that's done each year. They just came out with a 2001 report. And in the state of Oregon, hunters spent $481.8 million. To the state general fund, that generated $15.7 million. To the federal general fund, that generated $31.8 million. Anglers spent $733.4 million in the state of Oregon and generating $23.3 million of general fund for the state. $46.1 million of general fund for the federal. We don't have the total for viewers, for what viewers spent. We have what they spent. We don't have the general fund or the federal fund portion. That was not calculated by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. But people who viewed wildlife generated $769.4 million. Now, the totals of the general fund that hunters and anglers provided the state was $39 million. Of general fund tax. I guess, Mr. Chair, my point here is that fish and wildlife is big business in the state of Oregon.
Yeah. Almost $2 billion. That's a lot of money, Lindsay.
Yes, it is.
A lot of money in 1 year.
Yep. And it just, once again, signifies the importance of this agency and this agency functioning well.
Representative Nelson, a quick question.
Mr. Chair. I just want to give you a way to make the rest of your money.
Beg your pardon?
I want to give you a way to make the rest of this money that you needed back here on this other page, the $7 million of cost, you said.
Mm-hmm.
You've got $1.8 million. The state of Washington charges us over $20 to clam there. We don't charge them anything. And I think, this being the best clamming year we've had in years and years, they all came down here. So why don't we have a fee for non-resident clammers?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, since 1987, on five different occasions, the Department of Fish and Wildlife brought a shellfish license forward as a concept, and those five times it was soundly refuted by legislators. When we held our external budget advisory committee, we had committee members recommending to me that we needed a shellfish license. And I told the external budget advisory committee that I wasn't going to float that in front of the legislators. It hasn't done well in the past, and I didn't anticipate anything changing. I challenged them a little bit, I guess. I said, if you think we need one, I said, you need to be talking to some people. And that was on a Saturday, and on a Monday, there was a legislator that had a bill drafted. We continued to go around to our town hall meetings, and the general public at the town hall meetings favored a shellfish license.
I've been asked, Mr. Chair, to sponsor one on behalf of a 78-year-old clammer that's tired of this.
Very good. Let's debate the issue in the process, Representative. I think that's a fair question.
But Mr. Chair, that is a bill that I really think needs to be generated from other than an agency.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you.
Thank you again. And again, great work that you're doing and your staff, and we look forward to working with you this session.
Well, I thank you for your time.
You bet. Thank you. All right, the Chair would like to call Division of State Lands, if you have been patiently waiting. And do we have technology that is working?
Well, that's a question. If the technology doesn't work, then we're going to go the low-tech way. And
okay,
you,
all right.
You have handouts
we do.
In front of you. And so that we're not going to lose any time, I'm going to start talking. And if John Lilly can get it working, then we'll be able to switch. But let me make some introductions. To my right is John Lilly. He's in charge of policy and planning, the assistant director at the Division of State Lands. Steve Purchase, who's working on the easel, if it'll stay up. We're having other technical difficulties, too, there. Steve Purchase is in charge of field operations. He's also an assistant director. And then last but not least is Jeanette Holman. She's assistant director in charge of finance and administration. And if you have any questions about any issues or constituent concerns or legislation, please feel free to call any one of us. So let me start. And before you should have a handout that looks like this, which is a copy of the presentation you would see up there. But maybe we can pretend as we go along. Let me start off with the mission of the Division of State Lands is to ensure a legacy for...
Would you state for the record?
Oh, sorry. For the record, my name is Ann Hannes, and I'm the director of the Division of State Lands. Thank you. Introduced everyone else except myself. The mission of the Division of State Lands is to ensure a legacy for Oregonians and their public schools through sound stewardship of lands, wetlands, waterways, unclaimed property, estates, and the Common School Fund. We're actually one of the oldest state agencies because we go back to statehood when the state was given two sections out of every township as an endowment of land for our schools. That began with the state of Ohio. Our purpose is that we're the administrative arm of the state land board, and by the Constitution, the land board consists of the governor, the secretary of state, and the treasurer. We manage the Common School Fund assets. Those assets include the lands that I mentioned. If you look on this map over here, some of the largest tracts that we have are the Elliott State Forest, as well as black tracts here are a lot of rangeland that we have, submerged and submersible lands, and 3 miles out of the territorial sea. In addition to those assets, there's also roughly $680 million in the Common School Fund that's invested by the treasurer. It was, and then we also manage submerged and submersible lands as a result of an 1841 Act of Congress. That's about 500,000 acres. And then also the unclaimed properties, that is payroll checks that aren't claimed, dormant bank accounts, safety deposit boxes come into the state, and we hold them in trust. But in the meantime, the Common School Fund gets investment earnings off of that, as well as for estates where people don't have a will or don't have heirs. For 10 years, we hold it trying to find the heirs. If we can't find them, then that becomes the property of the state. In addition, we protect and conserve state waterways and wetlands. We also deal with South Slough Reserve and the Natural Heritage Program. In terms of our organization, it consists of the director's office, field operations, policy and planning, finance administration, South Slough Reserve, and the Oregon Natural Heritage Program. If you could put on your glasses and see on this little chart on the second, on page 2, that highlights a lot of the different activities we're involved in. We're a moderate-sized agency of about 80 staff, but we deal with a broad range of different land management activities. For submerged and submersible lands, we collect leases and easements from houseboats, marinas, our docks. We also collect royalties from gravel operations in navigable streams. All of this, again, goes into the Common School Fund. We manage rangelands, get grazing fees from that, and the and forest land management. Oh, this is looking a little bit more promising.
Always in safe mode. Look out.
Yeah, it didn't work this morning in here either.
We'll see.
Let's see what we got.
We got it to work in another conference room, so it's a try to see if we can get it working here. In the Constitution lays out the direction for how we should manage these lands, and that is that they're managed with the object of obtaining the greatest benefit for the people of the state, consistent with the conservation of this resource under sound techniques of land management. We have about 630 acres of rangeland and 133 acres of forest land, of which I showed you on the map there. On those rangeland leases, for example, we get $566,000 over the biennium that goes into the Common School Fund. We also manage all state-owned mineral rights, including exploration and production of leases. Territorial seas, a three miles out. That's one of the reasons why the Division of State Lands was dealing with the new CARISA, which I'm pleased that we did get a judgment of $25 million, but even better yet, we now have that $25 million being held in an account by the state, pending, of course, the completion of all the legal actions that are taking place. But it's nice to be able to have the money in our hands.
And what are you going to do with that $25
million? The judgment from the jury was for removal of the ship. That $25 million should be more than enough for removing it, paying for our legal expenses, and then we hope there'll be some left over too. And if there's some left over, then it would benefit the kids of the state through the Common School Fund.
So the legislature can't get their hands on it then?
For the next year to 2 years, until the appeals are exhausted, it's being held in a special account. So we can't get our hands on it either until that's all completed. So some other things that we are involved with in terms of collecting revenue for the Common School Fund, special uses, anything from if we have a motion picture that's filmed on state lands where we can collect some revenue from that, or easements that may be on state land. Oh, we're here. Okay. Thank you.
Good job.
Just figured out how to do that.
You want to turn the lights down a little bit, please?
If you you want to go up into slideshow, just slideshow right up there. There. Okay. Yeah, you're in.
Is that right?
Yeah. There we go. Oh, well. There we go.
Okay.
Okay. Hey, we do have technology now. Good. Submerged and submersible lands. These are, again, the bed and banks of navigable rivers. We have 350 waterway leases that earn $2.2 million and 1,200 dock registrations. In terms of forest land, we contract with the Oregon Department of Forestry, and they manage our Common School Fund lands. Again, the largest tract is the Elliott State Forest near Coos Bay, and that's our biggest revenue generator to the Common School Fund, roughly about $42 million per biennium. Removal fill program is a regulatory program that we manage in the Division of State Lands. We process permits for removal and fill. This is about 1,008 applications per year. The reason for the removal fill program is to protect, conserve, and make the best use of our water resources, to protect public navigation, fisheries, and recreation uses, to ensure that the activities of one landowner don't adversely affect another landowner, and to minimize flooding, improve water quality, and provide fish and wildlife habitat. Let me show you some examples of projects that we have worked with. This one is in Rock Creek in Columbia County. It was for bank stabilization and improved fish habitat. This one qualified for an erosion general authorization. The next one was for an irrigation diversion on the North Fork of the Butte Creek near Eagle Point. DSL issued a removal fill permit for this one. One of the things that we've been working on, especially in these economic times, is to try to figure out a way that we can ensure that there can be industrial land development. And so we've started a pilot project working with the Community Solutions team, and this one's aimed at Sutherland Industrial Park, and there's also a similar one in Lebanon. This is one where we're going to provide the technical assistance up front so we can be able to say, these are where you can develop, so we can make them, you know, shovel-ready as possible, basically doing all the pre-application work. Target for completion of this pilot project is this July. And I should add, John Lilly is the one that's spearheading that project. The wetlands program, we have, there are two wetlands benchmarks in the state strategic plan. One is for no net loss of freshwater wetlands per year, and the other one calls for a 250-acre increase in estuary and wetlands per year. And the wetlands program provides planning and technical expertise. We work closely on a cooperative basis with local governments, and so far we have 21 local wetland inventories that are in process, and we've already approved 18. South Slough National Estuary Reserve is another aspect of the Division of State Lands. This is located down near Coos Bay. We get 25,000 visitors there a year with 4,000 students visiting annually. It was the first designated national estuary in the country, and it's managed for research, education, and restoration projects. The Natural Heritage Program, which I won't go into too much here because you'll be hearing more about that in a minute, does a variety of things, identifies and preserves examples of the state's natural plant and landscapes. It's voluntary. It's one that provides an important database for public agencies as well as private individuals. Let me tell you just a little bit about the Common School Fund. It's a permanent trust fund to benefit current and future generations of the public school children aimed at grades K through 12, and all of the agency programs contribute to the Common School Fund. This next chart here shows basically the flow of revenue into the Common School Fund. To the left is the constitutional revenue. This comes off of our forest lands and our range lands, and those are the lands that we got upon statehood. To the right is the statutory revenue. Those are designated by the legislature, the waterway leasing, money that we earn from other submerged submersible lands. That was also the source that the legislature tapped in the third special session. It was a one-time amount of money, about $18 million, that we have sent out to schools in a special distribution as of December. And then the third source of money is the unclaimed property that's held in trust. The earnings from that big pool then flow out to schools, and so that it becomes a larger and larger fund over time, and that is our hope, and that it will continue to give increased distributions to schools over time. In terms of distributions, the State Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council invest the money. It's ranged between $600 to $800 million, depending on the fluctuations in the stock market. And as of November 30th, it was $683 million. Distributions have ranged between $9 to $41 million based on a policy of the State Land Board, and I already mentioned about the special distribution that was sent out. In terms of legislation that you'll be seeing, this is legislation that is natural resource-related legislation for the agency. The first one, House Bill 2253, would increase and restructure the way our removal fill permit fees are. It would raise about $417,000 for the biennium. The program, those fees really only cover less than 20% of the total cost of the program. So the balance then has an adverse effect on the Common School Fund. We also have tried to listen to what we heard last session from legislators as well as from input from the public and through a technical advisory committee about how to restructure those fees so that it has a better overall fee structure. The Senate Bill 218 That's one that's really a placeholder right now on the issue of navigability. Navigability's been a very hot one and a very contentious issue, and one that the land board has had to deal with, as well as many of you have heard from your constituents about it. The land board has asked the treasurer to head up a work group, which the treasurer is doing, and that work group is trying to seek a solution that they may be able to provide you with proposed legislation that might hopefully resolve this issue that's been around with us since statehood. So we'll see what happens with that work group. And then Senate Bill 219 has to do with removal fill streamlining. We've been trying to explore ways, including assumption of Section 404 out of the Clean Water Act, as a way to streamline the removal fill permitting process for the applicant, provide more certainty, and be able to ensure that they can get their work done. And then House Bill 2179, I believe, is before you today. Some of the issues that the agency has been wrestling with include rangeland management improvements, invasive weed problems on our rangelands, and trying to improve rangeland health and make needed improvements for our lessees. Property management issues in terms of ensuring that we can try to maximize the amount of revenue that we get off of our lands and ensure that the lands are being managed well. The Elliott State Forest is in the process of developing a management plan and revising their habitat conservation plan that they hope to have done within the next 1 to 2 years. Land sales and exchanges always are an issue of people either wanting to buy or exchange land and trying to set priorities on that. Removal fill program is an issue, concerns that are raised in terms of people trying to get permits or revisions, but also to try to streamline the process so that it is one that provides more certainty. I mentioned navigability. And then the last issue there is on the Common School Fund, trying to stabilize and increase distributions over time. Let me talk about the removal fill program for just a minute or two. Some of the concerns that we've heard about the removal fill program and actions we've tried to take over the last year to make improvements in the program. We've heard that that the rules, it's not been administered, it's not been consistent in getting a permit. We've revised the rules and reorganized them, and during the past year, we've provided much training to staff, to consultants and managers, and we've also developed guidelines and enforcement manuals so we can have clear direction to staff about how to administer that program. Another concern that we've heard is that coordinators follow personal agendas. In order to correct that, we have all the permits come through supervisors, and the supervisors review each of those permits, so we make sure that we have consistency. The permit processing is slow. Last session there was a Senate Bill 529 that was passed that requires that there be a 40-day completeness determination. We're averaging 18 days, so less than half of the time of what's been legislatively required. Senate Bill 529 also required that there be a permit decision then within 90 days of that completeness determination. We're well within meeting that timeline. And we've also set up so that there are automated email notices to application reviewers, and that people can now go on the web to review how their application and where in what stage they are in for that application. Let me talk about some of the things that we've been doing and working with our partners. In terms of rangelands, we've been working with ranchers and a weed management group on various weed control projects. I toured out in eastern Oregon this summer, and it was good to see some of the projects going on because some of the invasive weed problems are severe in some areas. We've also worked cooperatively with our lessees to reseed burned rangeland. Accomplishment of the department was reaching a fire agreement with the BLM. In Westside, Oregon, in our forest lands, fire protection is given by the Oregon Department of Forestry. But on the east side, one of the problems we've had for years is that east side rangelands have not had the same kind of fire protection. They've been essentially unprotected. And so we work with the BLM because a lot of our lands are adjacent to a lot of BLM lands or within BLM lands, and we've reached an agreement with BLM to provide fire protection for those rangelands. So it really does provide more certainty for our lessees. Another project that we worked on is the Owyhee Pipeline Project. This was a 17-mile pipeline that provided water for livestock so that it improved the overall health of that rangeland as well as provided water for wildlife and livestock and spread it out more evenly across that rangeland. We've tried to do a lot more training and outreach on the revised removal fill rules. We did presentations to landowner groups and organizations. We held sessions for environmental consultants, and we did presentations at professional seminars and conferences, and we've had meetings with local, state, and federal agencies. I should also add that in terms of exploring the whole idea of streamlining, we've held two workshops where we invited out of state from New Jersey and Michigan so they could say how it was in their state when they did the 404 assumption. So that's, I think, my last slide. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Members, do we have any questions of Ann? Yes.
Question, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can give me your reaction, DSL's reaction, or how we're proceeding in response to the recent letter from the Corps of Engineers regarding the jurisdictional guidance.
Let me, Chair Krupp, Representative Worth, let me call up John Lilly to talk about that. Are you speaking with regard to the removal fill permitting?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Worth, I believe you're referring
for the record.
Yes, sure. Thanks. Sorry. My name is John Lilly. I'm the Assistant Director for the Division of State Lands. To the question, I think you're referring to a recent notice from the Corps regarding the isolated wetlands issue and some rulemaking that both the Corps and the EPA are going through. That notice was given in order to put the regulated community and the environmental community on notice that the federal government was working through a rulemaking process to identify what kind of wetlands would be called isolated wetlands for purposes of the Clean Water Act. We expect that work is going to go on for some time, and at least it's my understanding that the Corps and EPA have not announced as yet particularly the criteria that they would use. This is an issue that's arisen from a lawsuit called the Swank decision. It deals with the federal court determination that certain types of wetlands are not regulated under the Clean Water Act, and so the federal administering agencies need to define for their rules what that category of wetlands might be. In Oregon, we currently regulate all wetlands, whether they're isolated or not. So in terms of current state law, the federal government's rulemaking would not have an effect on us. It may have an effect. In fact, our understanding with the current Portland District Corps is that they are attempting to apply some standards in order to determine what wetlands are isolated. But their findings are, for the most part, that wetlands in Oregon are not isolated. They're connected in some way, either by surface water or otherwise, to other waters of the state and the U.S., and therefore within their jurisdiction. We'll be watching this rulemaking carefully to see how it would affect the potential 404 assumption issues that we're working with, and there's a bill that Director Hannes has mentioned about that.
Very good. Thank you. Oh, well, yes. Representative Hunt.
Mr. Chair, I'm interested. There was discussion about the distributions from the Common School Fund. You talked about a $9 to $41 million annual distribution set by the Land Board. I guess I'm interested, is there statutory descriptions of how they can make that determination? It seems like a greatly fluctuating annual distribution for something that's really
Representative Krupp, Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, the basis for the distribution is the State Land Board's policy on distribution, and what that policy calls for is a sliding scale of a percentage of the fund, the change in the fund. So if the fund changes by a certain percentage each year, then a certain percentage of the fund is given out. In recent years, because it hasn't grown, in fact, we've lost money because of the stock market. We have 70% invested in equities. We've been only be able to distribute a 2% minimum of the fund. So in the boom years back in the late 90s, when the fund was really high up to like $800 million and we had a 15 to 20% increase in the fund, then the maximum was able to be given out of 5% of the fund. And so that's why we had a great fluctuation between $15 million to $41 million in what can be given out. One of the things that we are trying to explore is ways to stabilize that and ensure that we can provide at least a minimum to schools each year. So we are looking at that. It's been kind of it's boom and bust, and during the times where we need it the most, then we can only give the minimum amount.
Mr. Chair, if I might just follow up on that. Would that require a statutory change then, the changes that are being looked at, or is that just an internal policy change within the land board?
Chair Krupp, Representative Hunt, we do have legislation that I didn't put up there, one that would allow us to be able to use some of the amounts, earnings of the fund during a real boom time, like some of the capital gains of the fund during a boom time, and put that in a reserve account so we could smooth it over time. That is in one of our bills that will be introduced.
Okay, very good. With that, we're going to have to let you go. It's got to be really fast.
It's really fast.
Please.
Thank you very much, and thank you. And is it John, Lily, but you're called Jack, another one of those?
No, I am called John.
Oh, you're called John. Okay.
My mother said John anyway.
Okay. Director Hannes and Mr. Lily, it's my understanding that there have been several entities that wanted to build business in the state, like Intel, for example. We have individuals who would like to establish low-cost housing, which is needed just like those jobs. And we have about 240 wetland sites that should not be wetlands in the state, but we're not responding in 90 days to these issues. And could you account for those? Because I think it's greatly impacting the state, and let us know why those have happened. It took one application like Intel 2 years to get a response from DSL. And so something's happening. We have individuals whose land is actually higher than the highway that can't get a mitigated, whatever you call it, title, because they're designated wetlands. And, we have no responsiveness. And I'm greatly concerned. I have some constituents who really are concerned about it. But when it's building jobs and low-cost housing, I really think we ought to move.
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, I'd be very interested in knowing specifically which permits or applications they were so that we can look into that and whether or not that might have been the Corps of Engineers that had a long time or I'd like to know if it was us, because we want to make sure that we meet those 529 deadlines. And as far as, we've been meeting those over the last year. So if perhaps we can, talk and find out exactly which ones you're talking, because we are interested in trying to make sure that people can get their projects done and comply with the state law.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Stay right there.
Okay.
Now we're going to close the informational hearing. We're going to open a work session on House Bill. Pardon? Excuse me. A public hearing on House Bill 21. Members, Ray, you want to tell us just briefly what this bill is about? And members, we're probably going to go about 10 minutes over. So we have some folks who've traveled a distance to testify on this bill. We want to be sure to hear them. Appreciate your concern. Courtesy of staying around long enough to hear their testimony. Thanks. Great.
Chair Krupp, I'm going to. Jeanette Holman is going to
Very
take
good.
The lead on this one for me.
Thank you. Director Ray, what's this bill do and what are we accomplishing here?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2179 facilitates permanent transfer of natural resources, a data bank developed under the Oregon Natural Heritage Program to the Institute of Natural Resources at Oregon State University.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, In 1974, Nature Conservancy first created the Oregon Natural Heritage Program, and since that time, it's operated as a cooperative effort between Nature Conservancy, the state of Oregon, and several federal agencies. In 1979, the legislature passed the Oregon Natural Heritage Act and created opportunity for partnership between Division of State Lands and the Nature Conservancy to operate the Natural Heritage Program. Responsibility for maintenance of the program data bank was transferred from the Nature Conservancy to the Institute at Oregon State University by interagency agreement in June 2002. The statutory changes contained in this bill are needed for to complete the transfer of the program to the university from the Nature Conservancy, specifically the developments and maintenance portions of the program.
Thank you, Ray, and welcome, Jeanette. For the record, state your name and tell us about what the Heritage Program does and why we're transferring.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jeanette Holman. I'm the Assistant Director for Administration and Finance for the Division of State Lands. I'm very pleased to be here today. I started working on this project when I was still at Legislative Council, and it's nice to see the culmination of a project once in a while. Ray's covered some of it, but let me give you a little bit of history. The Oregon Natural Heritage Program provides a number of important services to the state of Oregon, including the creation of a discrete and limited system of heritage conservation areas that represent the full range of Oregon's natural heritage resources. It provides for the development of a framework and conservation decision making and the collection of a systematic, accessible information on the locations of the natural heritage resources of Oregon, including information about limited or threatened and endangered species, as well as some of our rare plants. But it also, the program includes not just threatened, but kind of representative samples of all kinds of native species and geologic formations that are kind of unique to Oregon. And the data bank is accessed daily by public land managers, private developers, researchers, and educators. The data bank portion of the Natural Heritage Program that House Bill 2179 would move permanently to the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University, where the information contained in this data bank will be combined with other natural resource information to expand Oregon's knowledge and information base on its natural resources. The Ray covered some of the history about this program started with the Nature Conservancy in 1974. In 1979, the act was enacted by the Legislative Assembly. This particular bill represents the culmination of a number of years' effort by the legislature, the Nature Conservancy, the Division of State Lands, and Oregon State University to transfer the data bank to a public entity. In the late 1990s, members of the Legislative Assembly, Division of State Lands, and the Nature Conservancy began to explore different options for locating this data bank in some sort of public entity. We looked at putting it in the Division of State Lands, fully fund it in that agency to transfer it to OEB, as well as looking at universities as an option. During the 2001 Legislative Assembly, we were directed by the Legislative Assembly to pursue moving it to OSU. We had been contracting with the Nature Conservancy to run it, and we managed to actually move that contract in June of 2002, which was a big accomplishment for everyone involved. But as we moved that, we decided that it would be worthwhile to make a permanent transfer so that there was no reason to keep this part of it within DSL. This will allow OSU to continue to operate it without the interagency agreement. We'll probably still use the program for some technical support for the rest of the Natural Heritage Advisory Council functions, but this database portion would be better served at OSU. With that, I will stop. I will be glad to answer questions. I know that Dr. Hal Salwasser and Jimmy Kagan are here if you have questions about how it's been operating since we transferred the program.
Representative Beyer.
Well, I don't know a lot about this, not having quite as much history as you do here. Was there a line item in any budget for this program, and is there any transfer of funds that go along with this?
Chair Cupp, Representative Beyer, we were directed in a budget note to pursue transferring it to the Oregon State University. We also received $100,000 of general fund money to help in that transfer because it was expected that there would be costs that Oregon State University would have that would be outside of what normally the program operated under. Traditionally, the Nature Conservancy had done a lot of the funding by grant and had picked up some of the administrative costs, and the $100,000 was included in to pick up some of those costs. The other part of that budget note was a direction to the Oregon University System to include it in their budget this biennium, or for the 2003-2005 biennium.
Jeanette, how much money are we talking about in terms of a budget item for OSU?
I believe it still is $100,000.
For the biennium?
Yes.
To administer the entire program?
That's my understanding. Now, Hal is here.
Well, we're going to ask him to come forward in a
okay.
moment.
But we get approximately $30,000 for support for the other parts of the program, the dedication and registration part, and administering the Natural Heritage Advisory Council. But so it's a total of about $130,000 of general fund. Much, much more money in federal and private grants is used to fund this program.
Mr. Trump?
Yes, Representative Mills.
Yes, thank you. Ms. Holman, do you have an agreement from Oregon State to accept this burden?
Chair Krupp, Representative Nelson, we have an agreement right now, an interagency agreement with Oregon State University for them to operate this part of the program. That would go away if this legislation passes because they would just have it as part of their responsibility.
Because by statute, we would direct Oregon State University to accept the program.
Well, Mr. Chair, we had this happen in an education committee last year. I just would like to see OSU, you know, make a formal acceptance.
We'll have the opportunity to chat with them in just a moment about that. Jeanette, what's the total budget for the National Heritage Program?
Mr. Chair, again, I think either Jimmy or Hal could tell you more of the grant funds that are there. I believe that what we had last year was the $130,000 plus about $69,000 of expenditure limitation for federal grants.
Okay, very good. Thanks, Jeanette.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you coming forward. Chair, I'd like to call Hal Salwasser from Oregon State University. Welcome, Hal. It's great to see you again, and for the record, state your name.
Thank you, Chairman Krupp. I'm Hal Salwasser. I'm the Dean of the College of Forestry and the Interim Director of the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University. We have indeed administratively transferred the data bank of Oregon's Natural Heritage Program, and it is currently being administered by the Institute for Natural Resources at Oregon State University. We have also, via interagency cooperative agreement, transferred the administrative responsibilities that Division of State Lands had to Oregon State University. And with that, transferred the $100,000 that was identified for support of the transfer and annual operations. The university does incur some direct indirect costs in administering the what is now known as the Oregon Natural Heritage Information Center to give it some distinction from the Heritage Program and Plan and Natural Areas Program. These costs are oversight by the Vice Provost for Research and by the Interim Director for the Institute for Natural Resources. The university bears those costs out of our own resources. The cost of hiring a person to do grants and contracts, it was previously handled by the Nature Conservancy and to cover part of the center director's salary that covers the director's support of the Oregon Natural Heritage Program and Natural Areas Program is where the $100,000 comes. The this is a recurring cost without which the center can't continue to fulfill its mission. So as directed by House Bill 5014, the amount is now included in the 2003-2005 budget of the Oregon University System. We anticipate that that will continue. We also anticipate that the indirect costs that the university is currently covering will eventually be covered by what we call indirect cost return on grants and contracts, the portion of grants and contracts that we use for administrative purposes. Chairman Krupp, we do have one concern over some language in House Bill 2179, and it's language that describes the purposes of the data bank at Section 3.2F. The second sentence in that is language from the 1979 Act that created the Oregon Natural Heritage Program. It reflects concerns at that time for data collection on private lands relevant to natural areas. The wording at Section 3.2F is somewhat ambiguous with regard to other types of observations. For example, much data is collected by remote sensing. That would not be considered to be a personal observation. Much data is collected by agency officials carrying out their legitimate functions under state or federal statutes, and they need to have the ability to enter listed data on data on listed or candidate species. And we would like to have an opportunity to work with agencies and the legislature on some revised language that would serve both agency needs and respect the rights of property owners. With that, I conclude my testimony. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Dean Salwasser. I think that we would be certainly interested in obtaining or entertaining, rather, some amendments to meet your concerns in terms of that language. Let me ask you this question. If the funding for this were not to materialize in the 03-05 budget for your department, what does that mean to you? How does it affect you?
The effect, Chairman Krupp, the effect would be to immediately put a hardship on the person who is out writing the grants and soliciting the contracts, which bring in around $400,000 to $500,000 per biennium. So we would have to pull back considerably from services that are currently being provided and try to backfill some for that position. It would curtail our ability to provide services to state, federal agencies, and the private sector.
All right. Members, additional questions for the dean?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nelson.
Salwasser. Are you going to have a good football team? Just kidding.
Chairman Krupp, Representative Nelson, the answer is yes.
Okay.
Go Beavs.
Just kidding. What is that other cost you're talking about? I heard you say you're going to take it over, but what is the total? Beyond the 169, what's the part that you indirectly assume at Oregon State?
Chairman Krupp, Representative Nelson.
The whole truth.
The whole truth? It'd be very difficult for us to estimate the cost of the amount of time that I, as the interim director, or Dr. Rich Holdren, as the vice provost for research, spend. We just consider that to be part of our duties of being administrators of a complex university operation. There is a tangible cost in there of about $5,000 a year that the university is right now covering to maintain internet connection for the information center staff. That is the part that we anticipate would eventually be covered by indirect cost return recovery.
I see. Okay. Well, members, we're not going to work this bill today. We will work the bill probably later in the week, unless we have some amendments coming forward, and I would, the chair would be happy to entertain those amendments at some point here to address the concerns of your language. Dean Salwasser, we appreciate you coming, and I would expect that we'll hear from you soon.
Thank you, Chairman.
On that issue. And with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2179. Members, thanks for your indulgence. One last thing before we go. The chair would like to allow Representative Nelson the opportunity to strike a particular word from her comments earlier in the hearing today.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier in a discussion with the Department of Energy, I was expressing my my agitation at those utility wholesalers who, yeah, I felt overcharged our people, and I called them jerks. And I would like to remove that. This is twice today, and I'm going to wash my mouth out with soap, if you all forgive me. And I won't do it again. And I'd just like to say those individuals who may have overcharged the citizens of Oregon instead of jerks.
Thank you, Representative, and point well taken. I'm sure that's a sentiment that that we all feel. So don't feel alone in terms of feeling frustrated on that issue. I think that's a broad sentiment. With that, thank you all very much, and we are concluded for today's business.
Let me ask this guy that.